You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining our panel discussion on how the COVID-19 pandemic has influenced college-going behavior. I'm Michael Hansen, Senior Fellow and Director of the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Over the past year, institutions of higher education have undergone unique crises and have made unprecedented adjustments to adapt to the COVID-19 pandemic. As colleges and universities have shifted to fully online or hybrid instruction models, student enrollment rates have simultaneously declined, while campus-wide sanitation and testing costs have increased. Declines in student enrollment have hit community colleges especially hard, raising concerns about reversing progress on college access for socioeconomically disadvantaged students. Meanwhile, student enrollment in for-profit colleges, many of which offered fully online degrees before the pandemic, has either stabilized or even grown. What will these enrollment shifts mean for college budgets? What about the future labor market prospects for impacted students? And what is the true value of a college education, and how will this shift in a post-pandemic world? These are the questions that we'll be addressing in the next hour. Thank you for joining us. And the Brown Center on Education Policy is very pleased to host this panel discussion today. We welcome those of you in the listening audience to participate in the conversation by using the hashtag #CollegeCovid on social media, and you can also submit questions by tagging the Brown Center using Twitter handle @BrookingsEd. Or by sending an email to events@brookings.edu. We will be pulling from these questions today during our panel discussion. First, now let me briefly introduce our panelists. The first panelist we want to introduce you to is Melanie Munzer. Melanie is serving as the newly appointed chief of staff to the office of the undersecretary at the U.S. Department of Education. Melanie recently performed duties as the associate vice president and vice provost for academic initiatives at the University of Oregon. And she was also an elected member of the board for Lane Community College and served in the education department during the Obama administration. Next, we have Doug Shapiro. Doug is the vice president of research and executive director of the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center. During the pandemic, the center has continued to lead the way as an integral part of the national post-secondary data infrastructure, and we look forward to hearing some of the lessons that they have learned. Our third panelist is William Serrata, who serves as the president of El Paso Community College. Across five campuses, El Paso Community College provides a quality and affordable education to more than 30,000 students coming from racially and economically diverse backgrounds. We look forward to hearing what is happening on the ground at community colleges from William. And our fourth and final panelist is Stephanie Cellini, professor of public policy and economics at George Washington University, and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brown Center on Education Policy at Brookings. During 2019, Stephanie served as a fellow at the U.S. House of Representatives Community on Education and Labor, and Stephanie's scholarship focuses on higher education policy and labor market outcomes for students. And again, we invite those of you at home to use #CollegeCovid on social media, and you can submit questions by emailing us at events@brookings.edu. So let's dive into the conversation. First, let's go to you, Melanie. Melanie, we're in the very early days of the new Cardona administration and are just beginning to hear about their strategies on higher ed. What can you share with us about what you're hearing about the secretary's priorities in this space?
Sure. Well, first, I wanted to thank you, Michael, for inviting me to join you today for this important discussion. These are incredibly challenging and uncertain times, as I'm sure the conversation today is going to highlight. Education is a foundational part of President Biden's agenda, with each and every student, no matter their parents' income, the color of their skin, their first generation status, having the opportunity to benefit from and contribute to a thriving middle class. And Secretary Cardona shares this conviction and is living proof of opportunities and education can provide. The top higher education priorities for the secretary are centered around three areas. So the first is creating pathways for students from high school into post-secondary and into good jobs. We know that 6 in 10 jobs require an education beyond a high school diploma, And we know that we're going to need to take a focused approach to developing a workforce that's equipped with skills to succeed in a globalized economy. The second priority is ensuring college is accessible and affordable. This also includes helping our student loan borrowers. We have a student debt crisis in this country, with roughly more than 44 million Americans now holding a total of $1.5 trillion in student loans. And one of five adults who hold student loans are behind on payments, and a disproportionate number of whom are Black. This means that student debt both exacerbates and results from the racial wealth gap. A third priority, of course, is then supporting students and institutions during the COVID crisis. We want to be able to fully reopen campuses safely and in a way that is supportive of students, faculty, and staff. And I'm sure I'm going to have a chance to dig into each of these in more detail throughout the conversation. Thanks.
Thank you, Melanie. Now let's go on to Doug. Doug, the National Student Clearinghouse has been tracking college enrollment across the country for more than two decades. What can you tell us about the long-term patterns of enrollment and how these may have shifted during the pandemic?
Well, we've been tracking and reporting on enrollment data for just the last decade or so, although the Clearinghouse has been collecting it for far longer. But the Research Center has been able to show, first off, the effect of the previous recession in 2008 and the long, slow recovery. And what we saw there was large increases in the number of students, particularly older students, as we expect in a recession. But many, many years of slowly declining enrollments, 1 or 2% a year ever since. And what we've seen this fall, where we've been reporting almost monthly with the latest up-to-date enrollment information from the colleges, is really modest declines overall, better than expected, I think, particularly when you consider the impact of the recession and the pandemic on other industries like travel or hospitality. Total enrollments in higher education are down only about 3%. So I think the economic hit for many institutions was less bad than feared. But for students, it's a different story. There were larger declines for undergraduates, 4.5%, much larger for community colleges, where 10% fewer students were enrolled this fall, larger still for freshmen, 13%, and truly staggering drops when you combine those last two categories, where we saw 21% fewer freshmen at community colleges this fall. Online institutions, of course, grew, reversing years of decline in the for-profit sector. And so part of what that says is that traditional colleges really did a great job of transitioning to online instruction. They did what they needed to do to hold on to their continuing students, even if they struggled to attract many new freshmen. But there's also more bad news when you drill down into demographic categories. Because part of what's behind the community college declines is the larger declines among low-income students and among Black, Latinx, and Indigenous students, far larger than other populations. This all adds up to growing equity gaps in higher education access and persistence. And I believe these are likely to remain with us for some time.
Thanks. That is very helpful context, Doug. Let's next go to William. William, as Doug says, community college enrollments are down quite significantly. And what can you tell us about how this is playing out from your perch in El Paso? Are you seeing drops across the board, or is there variation across different programs within your institution?
No, it's a great question. And thanks so much for having me. What a pleasure for me to be here with each of you. We're seeing exactly what Doug is referring to as far as enrollment at El Paso Community College. We were down just under 10% for this fall, about 9.5%. We continued that into the spring, about 12.5% down in enrollment. Specifically, we're looking at across demographic groups. We're about 85% Hispanic or Latinx students, and we saw a significant decrease. And what worries me the most is we've seen a significant decrease in first time in college enrollment. So we're down about 31% in FTIC enrollment in the fall. In the spring, it leveled off, but it's still down about 12%. And my biggest concern with that is, if you look at the depths of the Great Recession in 2008 until pre-pandemic, we saw about 12 million new jobs that were created in the nation. And of those 12 million new jobs, about 99% went to individuals with degrees and certificates. Only about 80,000 jobs nationally went to individuals with a high school diploma or less. And we had seen the Hispanic population slowly rise in percentage attending higher education. My fears are that the pandemic will wipe those gains out. It'll be a significant period of time before we're able to catch back up. So we're doing everything we can. We were about 91% of our courses being face-to-face before the pandemic, and we're about 92% of our courses being online currently. Working hard to try and ensure that we mitigate those enrollment losses for students across our institutions.
Excellent. Thank you, William. Finally, to Stephanie, what can you tell us about the economic consequences of these shifting enrollment patterns and what this may mean for students? What does delaying enrollment do? What about choosing a for-profit college over a more traditional institution? What does the evidence tell us?
Great. Thanks for having me, Michael. This is a great panel. I'm delighted to be here. These are all great questions. As I think Doug mentioned, typically community college enrollment is countercyclical. So that is, we see enrollment in community colleges especially rise in recessions as unemployed workers seek retraining and first-time students might go get that credential before they join the labor market. But in this recession, we're seeing the opposite with these declines in enrollment in community colleges in particular of about 10%. So when students are delaying college enrollment, they're delaying the employment and earnings gains that go along with it. They're delaying that shift to what we hope will be a higher paying and kind of more stable job that will help them weather future economic downturns and frankly put food on the table. So the research shows that public community colleges in particular have very high returns. They generate substantial earnings gains over the long run for relatively little debt. A delay means that students will have less time to reap the benefits of these earnings gains over their lifetime. So students won't see quite as large a payoff over time, assuming that they do actually eventually enroll. So that brings up the next question of will they eventually enroll? And it's likely that many of these students may not enroll. We have yet to see that. And they may lose out then on the monetary and non-monetary benefits of college altogether. Just to see this at older ages, you can imagine that we see fewer and fewer individuals enrolled at these older ages. So, one additional concern that really strikes me with my own research on for-profit colleges is that students will shift from community colleges and enroll elsewhere, like at for-profits and online institutions. The National Student Clearinghouse data that Doug mentioned shows the latest numbers seem to suggest that enrollment's up in the for-profit sector, about 4% up this spring, and that's the only sector showing gains right now. And if we look at primarily online institutions, many of which may be for-profits, enrollment there is up about 7%. So both of these patterns are somewhat concerning to me, because the research shows that both sets of institutions, for-profits and online learning, have kind of worse outcomes than community college programs. We are concerned about earnings gains in particular that are lower in the for-profit sector. Research shows that it's at least $2,000 less in a for-profit college per year that students are making when they leave a for-profit compared to a community college. Tuition is much higher at for-profit colleges, leaving students with more debt. They are much more likely to default on their loans when you put those two things together. students in for-profits, about half of them default on loans after about 12 years after enrolling in their education. About half of them will default on loans, as opposed to only 13% in community colleges. So I do think there's some very serious concerns about students enrolling in for-profits and online institutions. There's some new research on online learning as well that shows that many times students do worse in online courses in terms of lower grades, less success in higher level courses, lower test scores. And it's particularly a challenge for less academically prepared students. So I do think those are some things we need to keep our eye on as we move forward. Thank you, Stephanie. Back to Mike.
Yeah, thank you, Stephanie. So I'm hearing concern from our panelists about the impacts on students. Any sense, now I'm just opening this to any panelist in particular, any sense of whether these declines in enrollment that we're seeing, are these going to simply be temporary declines and hopefully we're going to have a rebound next year? Or are you worried that this may be something more permanent?
So I'll jump in, Michael. And what we're looking at is, if you look at the start of recessions and the impact to community colleges, at least in Texas, it's about a year and a half. It's about an 18-month lag between the beginning of a recession and when we start to see the enrollment increases. So theoretically, this fall would be 17 months from the start of the recession in March of last year. And so we're hopeful, and yet it really depends on the widely availability and distribution of the vaccine. We're seeing still in El Paso where I had a board member who traveled to Midland, Odessa, and that's about a 6-hour drive from El Paso because she was able to get a vaccination quicker in Midland, Odessa than she was able to get it in El Paso. So it really depends on the widely available and the distribution of the vaccine to ensure that our students feel safe. We do see a segment of the student body, in particular, first-time in college students. We were down, as I indicated, 31%, that just don't seem to be ready or willing to take on online enrollment. And so we want to make sure that we can be face-to-face. We want to make sure that we can do that safely. If we can do that safely, then I do anticipate the rebound. And hopefully it'll be this fall. If it's not this fall, then potentially the spring, but no later than next fall, do we anticipate a rather significant rush of students.
Thank you.
This is Melanie. I'm also happy to chime in here. I don't think any of us really know the answer to the, is this going to be permanent or not? But I think what we do know is that we're going to have to approach enrollment with more intention. So, right, it's unlikely that students, particularly low-income, first-gen, students of color, particularly at under-resourced institutions like community colleges and MSIs, are just going to come running back to higher ed without help. I did want to talk very briefly about a few of the actions that President Biden has called for that hopefully will help improve access for students and help mitigate this. So the first is providing 2 years of community college free. Second would be supporting low and middle income students with tuition assistance when attending 4-year HBCUs and other MSIs, significantly increasing the amount of Pell. We know that Pell is not keeping up at all with the cost of college and now only pays for about a third of the total price tag for a 4-year public. Investing in CTE and training programs, but then also ensuring that we are expanding access to who has these opportunities, particularly including undocumented students.
That's some great information. Thank you, Melanie. Doug, quick question with National Student Clearinghouse data. If we are seeing different people going to different institutions, say selecting a for-profit, are you able to track and see if there's any changes in transfer behavior between institutions over time?
Yes, in fact, we've released quite a bit of data from the fall term about transfer behaviors. And one of the things that we found that was quite surprising to me was that transfer overall had also fallen during the pandemic. A lot of people expected that the disruptions caused by the pandemic and the recession would cause a lot of students to shift institutions. They might stay enrolled, but they might move from their four-year expensive institution across the country to a local community college to save money, to avoid travel, and maybe to just kind of ride out the recession that way. We found that that behavior plummeted during the recession. We call that reverse transfer from a four-year to a two-year. And far fewer students did that this year than last year. On the flip side, students transferring from a two-year to a four-year institution was virtually unchanged, a slight decline, but it was differentiated, and it was clear to see that some of the more upper income and more advantaged students were able to capitalize on the opportunity of having four-year institutions that were more in need of students. And they made the leap from community colleges to a four-year institution where they might not have been able to in a normal year. On the other hand, low-income students, students who would have stayed local and ordinarily transferred to, say, a local public four-year institution, those numbers declined. So we really saw in the transfer numbers just more of an example of the recession and the pandemic exaggerating and exposing some of the existing inequities that we've been struggling with for years in higher education.
Thank you, Doug. This is very informative. Now, a quick question to Stephanie. And we'll initially address this to Stephanie, but I'm going to address a couple elements of it to others after Stephanie's response. This is an audience question coming from Ulrika from the New York City Department of Consumer and Worker Protection. Ulrika asks, many nonprofit and public universities now offer online-only programs that are administered by for-profit online program management companies. Do we have any reason to believe that these programs offered from nonprofit institutions, but through for-profit providers, that they have any different types of outcomes associated with them than, say, a strictly for-profit institution may have? Do we have any reason to believe that their outcomes for students may be different? Stephanie, do you have any thoughts here?
Yeah, that's a great question. We actually don't have a lot of quantitative research on this question, mostly just kind of anecdotal evidence from several recent cases. My guess is that labor market outcomes, debt, default, those types of outcomes will be really similar to what they were before and not necessarily great. I have no reason to believe that relabeling some of these institutions or repackaging them in a different way will really change their incentives and the underlying kind of structure and practices that they have. What I worry about with these types of conversions and mergers is that these kind of blurring of these sectoral lines will really kind of undermine the respect and trust in the kind of public and nonprofit labels, making it harder really for students to use those as indicators of kind of quality or practice or differences there. So I think the blurring of lines becomes very difficult for students. I don't necessarily know that we'll see different outcomes. So I think, to kind of throw it to policymakers here, but I would think that we and kind of urge additional accountability and thinking about student outcomes in these kind of combination converted for-profits into nonprofits or merged institutions and kind of thinking through that and how we want to address that. And maybe looking at student outcomes and having those schools be held accountable.
Okay, that's a great pivot. Let's go to Melanie now. As the Cardona administration is looking at for-profit accountability, and we generally expect that there will be some coming down the pike at reversing the trend during the DeVos administration, is this type of partnership where we're seeing for-profit providers offering services through a nonprofit or public entity, is this type of partnership on the radar as something to police or monitor for among universities?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I agree with Stephanie. This is a really good question. So I would obviously say in general, ensuring students are well served through their academic programs and institutions and that they have access to an affordable education is definitely, you know, kind of quote unquote on our radar. You know, as Stephanie mentioned, this gets really complicated in terms of how institutions are labeled. So a lot of what we'll look at is not necessarily specific to for-profit institutions or programs, but we are very acutely aware of the disproportionate negative impacts that for-profit institutions have, particularly on low-income students and students of color. I could kind of go through a whole litany of statistics on, you know, the problems in the for-profit sector. Stephanie had mentioned a few earlier, you know, highlighting in particular that students who started at for-profits tend to default on their student loans at a rate 3 times higher than those who started at nonprofits. So I would say the secretary is very committed to protecting students and safeguarding taxpayer funds from failing and fraudulent institutions and programs. And we're taking a look at numerous areas. A few examples would be the borrower defense claims against repayment of loans for institutions that have used bad faith efforts to take advantage of students. And also, you know, looking at how to reinvigorate the past work of the department on accountability regulations such as gainful employment. But the secretary will definitely want to ensure that any nonprofit institution partnering with for-profits aren't replicating the challenges in the for-profit sector. I will note also that accreditors play a critical role in this effort. And, you know, if they are not able to fulfill their obligations, they would also be held accountable along with the institutions. In general, the secretary will want to strike a balance between fairness, reasonableness, and cost. And he's going to rely on both transparency and accountability to ensure the proper oversight of institutions and the federal student aid program.
William or Doug, do either of you want to jump in on this one?
Yeah, I would say that I'm obviously very much in line and very much in accordance with what with everything that Melanie is saying. I would touch on something that she mentioned earlier as far as 2 years of community college free, Pell increases, and in particular the CTE and training programs. That's an area of enrollment that we actually saw increase both in the fall and in the spring. So our workforce programs, we saw an increase, and we continue to see that as it moves forward. We're seeing that students want to enroll in programs that lead them directly into the workforce as opposed to waiting for transfer programs. And so we had already started to transition the institution to be able to provide more. The only issue with those are expensive programs. They're hard to start up. They're not cheap. And we've invested about $125 million across the 5 campuses to increase the CTE offerings so that students can have access to those. And we've seen the results despite enrollment declines. We saw enrollment gains in those particular programs.
Great. Thank you, William. Let's go to a next question here. We briefly mentioned, William, in your earlier comments, you mentioned about getting people vaccinated. And here's a question. Is a fully live normal reopening a critical and necessary piece here to prevent further declines for traditional colleges and universities? Is there a role? Do we need vaccines, you know, mandatory for all incoming students? Is this something that we need to be paying attention to? Any thoughts here, either to William or anybody else on the panel?
So I'll begin, and I'm sure others will chime in. So I would love to see it required, all the vaccines, all 3 vaccines under emergency authorization, and therefore they cannot be required. We've had board members that have looked at this. We've looked through the Attorney General's opinion in the state of Texas, as well as the governor's. They're very quick to point out that anyone who wants a vaccine can get a vaccine. You know, we've had other laws in the state of Texas. Bacterial meningitis is one that comes to mind quickly, where the legislature mandated that be required for students that are coming in, specifically for dorms. But we have to check all first time in college students on that particular area. But I do think that what you're seeing is in El Paso, at least in our region of the state of Texas, a real desire for that vaccination. We're roughly at about 10 or 11% that are fully vaccinated, about 20% that have received at least one vaccine. The rollout is accelerating rather rapidly, and we're hopeful that by going into the summer, that we'll be able to see this increase rather dramatically, where we'll be able to offer at least 50%. Our plan is 50% for face-to-face classes in the fall. And if we can expand on that, then I'd see that enrollment will begin to increase.
Okay, thank you. Related to this, we know that the pandemic has hit communities of color especially hard. And we have reports of vaccine hesitancy to be a little bit higher among those communities. Are there strategies, you know, within this realm to ensure that communities of color are also participating and are able to access school on a regular basis? And this is open for the panel.
So one thing I think that I would mention that needs further exploration, but would be especially partnerships with MSIs and community colleges. So, you know, HBCUs, TCUs, they all have deep connections within their community. And I think partnerships for helping with vaccine distributions through these institutions could go a long way in helping to ensure that people within the community are getting vaccinated, both on campuses and within the general community itself. So I think that's an area that should be explored further and that the administration will be looking into.
Okay, excellent. Just for the audience, we welcome those in the audience, of course, to contribute to the conversation by using hashtag CollegeCOVID on social media and ask questions. You can also submit questions to events@brookings.edu, or you can use Twitter handle @BrookingsEd. And let's go to the next question. We're going to transition a little bit and now focus on college finances for a few minutes. We know Congress just passed a $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. $40 billion of which is going to higher education spending. Is this enough? How should institutions be thinking about prioritizing the funds that we get? Maybe to kick this off, let's go to Doug first. This is an audience question from Matthias of Swiss National Public Radio. Do we know how many colleges have shut down during the pandemic? And what is known about the closure of specific departments within any institutions?
That's a good question. I don't know the actual number. I don't think it's very high. I think a lot of schools are still hanging on, even if they're suffering from budget declines due to the lower enrollments and increased costs. I think the question, though, is more about the schools that have been most affected, and you know, those with declines in the double digits in enrollments. I think they really have to focus on, regardless of how much stimulus aid they get, how are they going to restore those enrollments? And because at some point, you know, you can't have a freshman class that for the next 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, as that group of students, that cohort moves through the system, they're going to continue to depress overall enrollments for years to come. And colleges really have to find a way to bring those students back, which is, I think, increasingly challenging the longer students are separated from the educational infrastructure and the supports that normally, say, a high school graduate is spending all of that spring term and much of the summer working with advisors and admissions counselors and this whole infrastructure that helps students bridge and transition from high school into college. And if I think of these students, particularly first generation students who don't have access to even a parent who's been to college and knows how this works, their ability to get back into the pathway of higher education is going to become more and more attenuated as time goes by. And I worry that many of those students will never make it back as their lives continue to go on without being connected to the educational system.
And I might add a little bit to that, just to piggyback on Doug's point, if I may.
Sure.
I was thinking about the institutions that have, you know, been well positioned to kind of weather this downturn. And you think about online online institutions in particular that had no dorms, no, you know, food, room and board to pay for, no cafeterias. You know, they were already ready to go, many of them, with advertising that was directly geared towards the kind of online night working student. You know, I think that some of these for-profit online institutions in particular were just very well positioned going into this. They've already had faculty who have taught online. You know, a lot of that transition there financially seems like they would have weathered, the larger online ones would have weathered the storms quite well financially. And then some recent work I've done has looked at advertising. And I think that this is something that I do feel, you know, the for-profits are spending a lot on commercial advertising. We see it kind of stepped up at the start of the pandemic to get students in the door into these online programs. And I really think that community colleges need the support to be able to do more outreach so that, you know, Williams College can advertise those CTE programs, those new programs that students might not necessarily know, you know, the community college is offering for a much lower price than the ones they're seeing on TV online. So I would just kind of add that there, that we need to support those public community colleges and potentially let them kind of do more outreach and help them do that to the community to make sure that students will come back in.
If I may pivot then to William, how does your budget look right now? And with this infusion of funding from the stimulus, is that enough to offset any declines that you've seen from state and local funding? Tell us what it looks like from your perspective.
Sure. It's a great question. It's one that we're in the midst of right now. So as we finished last spring, we were preparing for this. We saw what's counterintuitive, and I'm sure that Doug has seen this as well. We saw record enrollment last summer. And so at our community college and most in Texas, we saw record enrollment, despite the fact that we transitioned completely online as of March 13th of last year. And so we saw this surge in enrollment. It was in the fall that we started to see the decline subsequent spring. We're in the middle of a base year in the state of Texas, which is our funding mechanism. And so the legislature's in session right now. And we are seeing, and we've been the federal government. And so thank you, Melanie, you and your team at Department of Ed have been incredibly gracious. And we've received significant amount of funding, of which all told, we're seeing about $120 million of funding. About $50 million has been designated for students. It will grow depending on the need. And we're making this work. We're making the budget work. We cut out, as we went into the fall, we planned for a 20% decline in enrollment. We saw about a 10%, so that helped. But we literally had to cut the budget. And so we cut nearly $10 million from last year's budget to this year's budget. We didn't have any reductions in force or any furloughs, but we did tighten the belt quite a bit. Now, the federal resources have helped tremendously. The CARES Act obviously was much more stringent, and I won't bother to ask Melanie, because I know that she's in the midst of working all of those out, about how flexible we'll be able to use the new resources and whether we'll be able to utilize those for additional services for students.
Melanie, can you offer a little bit about where the $40 billion in higher ed spending is intended to be going? And if you can comment on the flexibility question, that'd be great too.
I can provide some insight. So what I will say is that the department's going to be releasing more information on the specifics for the $40 billion, which we are calling now HERF 3, and also though some additional flexibilities in how the funds from HERF 1 and 2 can be used in the coming days. So I can't provide any more insights right now, but there will be some more information out soon. The $40 billion is generally going to be used with the same terms and conditions as HERF 2. There's a slight change in the distribution. So, you know, for example, now 91% of funds, I think it was 89%, but I might have that number wrong, under HERF 2. But under HERF 3, 91% will be allocated to public and private not-for-profit institutions. 7.5%. which is about $3 billion, will go to HBCUs and MSIs. There'll be a small amount of 1% for proprietary institutions. and then 0.5%, which is about $200 million, for grants to institutions with the greatest unmet needs. So that includes institutions with large populations of graduate students and those who may not have received awards under the prior two HRF authorities. It still will have kind of the same broad headers for the use. So looking at building the institution's capacity to serve students both during the pandemic and long after, helping vulnerable students remain in and re-enter college, and then taking evidence-based approaches to dealing with the coronavirus cases locally. I would say in all of this, though, what the department would prioritize is that we're putting first the, the focus first on students of highest need. That is by far, I think, where we will see the greatest need for these funds and where they will have the biggest impact.
Excellent. Thank you, Melanie. Here's a question from Jeff from HP. He asks, what pandemic changes at colleges will be long lasting and what will be more likely to revert to the old normal? I guess let's just focus on the first part of that. What do you see as changes that are going to be long lasting for practice? Maybe let's start off with William.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I do see that our mode of instruction will be long lasting. And so prior to the pandemic, we were about 91% of our students being face to face. We only had about 9% of students who were completely taking courses online, another 17% that were supplementing their schedules. So one online course, one face to face. And we, you know, as of March of last year, we reversed that. We have 92% of our courses that are now online. Only about 8% of our courses, think lab intensive courses, clinicals, and CTE programs that are in a face-to-face format. I don't see that shifting back. I see that there is some students that have benefited and that have done really well in this online learning. And now that you have all community colleges that have transitioned, you may see long-term a preponderance of students to come back to the community college as opposed to, for instance, the for-profits. I think that we'll see a larger percentage of our student body that will take online courses and that we'll get back to, I would imagine right now, probably 70-75% of courses being face-to-face, but a significant segment of our population taking courses online.
Thank you. There's a related question, Guilherme from the Le Mans Foundation. He asks whether graduate programs, especially master's programs, will change post-COVID. Stephanie, I know that you help administer a master's program at George Washington. Do you see your master's program changing in fundamental ways?
Well, we have switched to online classes in our master's public policy and public administration programs that I work at over at GW. Let's see. So more online courses. Students tend to continue their jobs, I've noticed. They're staying employed and coming to evening classes and, online classes they can do on a lunch break, but they're maintaining their jobs and doing part-time master's programs more than kind of the full-time standard model that you might think of more traditionally. I'm trying to think of other changes at the master's level. I hope some employers will be able to help meet the need for students and give them some grant funding or other types of funding. I haven't seen that yet, but I know that with a lot of colleges, having budget shortfalls, we do hope that employers might help fund some graduate education too.
Excellent. Doug, have you seen, can you comment on enrollment changes in graduate vis-a-vis undergraduate during the pandemic?
Sure. So I think it's an important connection. I think one area where students have been essentially voting with their feet, especially at the graduate level, but also to some extent in the undergraduate level, is towards shorter term programs, shorter term classes, and more short term credentials that can be stacked. So that's where the enrollments at the graduate level are growing the fastest. And I think that students are going to get used to that, and particularly working adults who are often wary of a longer term commitment. You can say that would also be true for an unemployed adult today. In my view, one of the things that has suppressed the normal countercyclic enrollment effect of a recession has been this kind of unfounded, as we know now, assumption on the part of many unemployed workers that everything was going to bounce back. You know, the recovery was right around the corner all through last year. Oh, we're going to, you know, all these jobs will come back in a month. Why would I want to start a new degree program now? So I think that that suggests that colleges that are more able to hold on to or initiate these transitions to making degree programs, certificate programs, and courses themselves, individual courses, into shorter chunks of commitment and time on the part of the students, the more they will benefit.
Excellent. Thanks, Doug. We're now going to be transitioning to the audience Q&A portion of this segment. And so we welcome those in the listening audience who participate in the conversation by using hashtag #CollegeCOVID on social media, using the Twitter handle @BrookingsEd, or by sending an email to events@brookings.edu. I've got a couple of questions here, and as we go through these questions, we'll probably go through them a little bit more quickly, but let's start off by first asking this of Melanie. Beth is an education researcher, and she asks, how readily available is access to technology that is essential for online learning? And so this would be, of course, connectivity and devices. And how is the Cardona administration planning to address disparities in access to technology in higher education?
Yeah, thank you for this question. I'll highlight a couple of things. One is, I think that we have to recognize now that technology and broadband access has become a basic need. You can't really survive in a higher education as a student anymore without having access to it, particularly at this time. So because of that, you know, there are a couple actions that are already out there. Obviously, the American Rescue Plan and the HRF $3 can be put towards technology and broadband access. The department is engaging in conversations with the FCC to see about how we can partner there for expanded access. And then I would also point out that one of the very first things that President Biden did on, you know, his kind of first full day in office on January 21st was to sign an executive order giving direction to the department to do some specific things around COVID. One of those is that we're going to be developing a Safer Schools and Campuses best practices clearinghouse. We'll actually start collecting best practices for the clearinghouse in the next few days. And this will allow us to hear how institutions have really been making these resources available to students and then sharing these practices across the country so everybody can learn from each other. So I don't think that there's a perfect answer for this right now, but you know, the secretary is really committed to ensuring that this is top of mind.
Great. And William, did you have something you wanted to add there?
I do. So we this is an area that we utilized our CARES Act dollars significantly in preparing both faculty and staff as well as students. So you think of your faculty and staff and you come into the office, you have your desktop and you're used to using that. And then all of a sudden you're working from home and you realize you don't have devices. And so to date, we have purchased just under 3,700 devices. We've purchased about 2,400 laptops, over 850 hotspots, under 200 webcams, document cameras, as well as printers. And we check these out to students. We provide them to faculty and staff as well. We did do do a survey of our students in the spring semester, and we had a significant N returned, nearly 70%, so well over 17,000 students that replied. And we were surprised, just given, you know, you think of El Paso, very urban area, but there are rural areas of the county, and about 93% of our students told us that they had a device. About 91% of our students said that they had access, reliable access to the internet. And so that really moved us forward in purchasing the devices and the hotspots to be able to provide and check those out to students. So we're pleased that we're being able to see this. What we do see is we see a number of students who may not turn on their camera. And there's a variety of reasons. You have large families, you have siblings that are in the backgrounds. And so we've had to work with our faculty and do trainings on what the expectations should be for online learning.
Great. Thank you. I've got a question here for Doug. Jane from the Council of International Schools asks, how are universities changing their enrollment strategies that you're aware of?
Well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't really have much awareness of what schools are doing for their their strategies. I see what happens when the students are already on campus and how many of them have shown up and how many haven't. But we don't really know what the colleges are doing to get them there.
Okay. I could just briefly chime in. The best sure. practices clearinghouse that I mentioned, this would be, I think, a great area to have highlighted in there. So, the department can try and get access to some of this information and publish it so that others can also share and learn from each other in this area.
Okay, great. here's a question. Maybe this would be a good one for William. Ellen from the Schmidt Foundation asks, what are the pandemic's impacts on the performing arts? It sounds like they're curious to know about the arts program's enrollment and vis-a-vis other more traditional academic programs. And also, how soon will it be before colleges start hosting concerts and plays again?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we're very proud of the community involvement on our respective campuses. They are gathering spaces for the community. And we've had to hold off on that due to the pandemic, just based on spacing and ensuring CDC guidelines. What we saw in those particular programs is we saw a decline in enrollment in those programs as well. It is only the CTE programs and the career technology specific programs that we saw a slight increase, about 5%. Increase in the fall and spring, and we're continuing to see that decline through the spring term. We look forward to being able to host people on campus, to be able to have these events, but we have to ensure the safety and security of our campus. I also saw a question with regards to, obviously, Governor Abbott in Texas was one of the first states to remove the mask mandate. We are allowed, colleges and universities are allowed to continue to move forward with what we feel is safe. And so we have continued with our mask mandate on our campuses. We've continued to follow CDC guidelines and social distancing. And we will continue to do that as long as the governor's executive order allows us to do so.
Excellent. Thank you, William. we have a question from Felicia in the New York State Senate. Who asks, do any of the panelists have suggestions for helping 2020 alumni who just recently graduated with jobs as they graduate in a pandemic with little to no opportunity for job advancement and a very difficult labor market? Maybe Stephanie, do you have any comments here?
Sure. There is some research from the last recession that does show that there's really long-term impacts on students graduating during a recession, that it really can push down their earnings. And so it is a concern thinking about students graduating in the recession. I will say, I think the stimulus and the American Rescue Act, helps if we can get out of this, if we can get vaccinated, if the economy starts doing better and we have some growth, that's going to go a long way in helping those 2020 grads with opportunities to take off again. So I think a lot of that kind of labor market growth that we need to have happen, I think we're moving the right direction, hopefully to see a recovery, I hope. So, you know, I see a part of that question, I believe, was also about mental health resources and career resources. I think those are both going to be really, really important in helping students kind of transition to the workplace after. Maybe somebody else wants to comment more on those, but.
Sure, Doug.
I might just add that to the extent that some of those 2020 graduates have joined the wave of more students entering graduate programs and graduate certificates, that could help them in the long run.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. This is a question that kind of piggybacks on the comments here, both from Stephanie and Doug. Christine of the ECMC group asks, high school students are more and more questioning the value of getting a four-year degree. How should we be investing in other pathways that deliver valuable career skills and credentials without the debt and the time investment of a four-year degree? You know, the question is a four-year degree still worth it?
I'd love to jump in and say, yes, a four-year degree is still worth it. It is still worth it. I know it's expensive. Most borrowers are able, when they graduate from a bachelor's degree program in traditional colleges, public and nonprofits in particular, we see that they are able to repay their loans. Bachelor's degrees do still pay off for most students. Having said that, there are major concerns with students who potentially go to for-profit colleges. Again, that's the one sector where we've seen that things are troubling. And students who don't complete their degrees. Degree completion is really important. Something when we think about degree completion, I do really think Doug's point about stackable credentials and shorter-term credentials, going to college still pays off, but get those short-term credentials in the meantime, and maybe you can stack them to build up in case, so there's a fallback plan where you have a credential when you leave and you're not leaving with a lot of debt and nothing to show for it. So completion is key, supporting students so that they can complete. And that means we need Pell Grants. That means we need to help our students out as much as we can through this recession and helping them get that degree to complete. Because for the most part, it is worth it. We also need the federal government to make sure that we're looking over the shoulders of some of these schools and making sure that students are getting value for their degree at the bad actors or the, you know, any schools that are not giving that kind of promise, that are not living up to their promise, I should say.
Excellent. William, it looked like you may have wanted to jump in. I know it touches on the CTE angle you brought up earlier.
Yeah, I would. And this is something that we see as far as our specific enrollment. And we've seen dual credit and early college high school enrollment continue to grow, actually, during the pandemic. And so they're doing them online as well. But we've seen that, or in particular, the early college high school programs continuing to grow. And so I absolutely agree with Stephanie that now's not the time to say I'm going to put off higher ed. We've seen this play out. And if, you know, in our community, if students don't enroll immediately after high school graduation, the summer or fall after, the likelihood they ever earn a credential in El Paso is 1%. And so we want to make sure that they have that 99% chance of earning that credential. You're looking at a lifetime earnings that make this worthwhile. And so I would encourage anyone to continue their enrollment process.
Okay. Thank you, William. We're getting close on time. I just wanted to go around the bend one more time and just let anybody have a final word here. Let's start with you, Melanie. Any final parting words about looking forward as we move forward in the pandemic?
I just wanted to thank you again for inviting me today. One thing I didn't mention is that the department had recently released K-12 COVID guidance, but we are also working with the CDC on higher education guidance. So that will be coming out in the next few weeks, and we'll be a partner to that best practices clearinghouse that I had also talked about. So I think we are very wanting to hear from everybody on when the guidance is out, what type of impact it might have, if there are other things that we should be including in it, and other ways that the department can work with and serve the community to ensure that our students have access to education.
Excellent. Doug, Do you have any last words you wanted to add?
Well, just to reemphasize what we've talked a lot about, that this really seems to be more and more a story about the economic divide and the exposure of inequities that have been part of our society for a long time. We've seen, the talk about the K-shaped recovery and the haves and have-nots. You know, if you're unemployed, as I was just saying, and you already have an undergraduate degree, this is a great time to gain more skills and credentials, even if you have to borrow for it. But if you don't, and if you're just struggling to pay for rent and food, much less tuition, and we've talked about high-speed internet and devices for online learning, you're really unlikely to be able to benefit from this opportunity. And I think that means that we risk as a society, if we don't address some of these inequities, that the gaps between those haves and have-nots will continue to grow wider, and that we're sowing the seeds for future economic disparities as today's students or would-be students move into the workforce.
Okay, thank you for that sobering warning. Stephanie.
I thought Doug wrapped that up really well. I second what he just said. I am concerned moving forward, and we need to make sure that the gaps between the haves and have-nots don't grow. We need to really be looking at how to help students of color, how to help students who are first generation, how to get into college, how to move through it, how to complete. Let's get students back with degrees and credentials that they can use in the labor market as we hopefully recover, and that they can have full opportunities moving forward.
Thank you, Stephanie. And William, any parting final words from El Paso?
I just think that it's imperative that students realize that the pathway to the middle class is through higher ed. The data is overwhelming, that getting into and being successful within higher ed is the way to secure that middle class opportunity for you and your families. And it changes generations. And so I was a first generation college student 35 years ago. My children have no choice. They have to go to college, other than where they go after they complete their associate's degrees at El Paso Community College is their only choice. And it's just imperative. We are a knowledge society. It is important that we get as many students in. And I'm quite concerned about, in particular, the minority populations. We had seen really consistent increases, and now we've seen the bottom somewhat fall out. So really worried about getting them back into the system and helping them be successful.
Excellent. Thank you. These are excellent parting comments from all of you. Melanie, Stephanie, Doug, William, I appreciate you taking your time out of your schedules to be here with us. And thank you to everyone in the audience for listening in. Also, thanks to Letty, Nico, and Dan for helping organize the event on the back end. We really appreciate your help. And thanks everyone for tuning in, and hope you have a great rest of your week. Take care.